This is Charlotte Frascona. I'm interviewing Jonathan Zeitlin on November 22, 2004. Jonathan, could you please briefly describe your educational and professional background, where you did your grad and undergrad work, and what positions you've held?
Right, sure. I got my BA at Harvard in social studies, which was a sort of interdisciplinary history and social science program, where I was already fairly interested in labor issues. Then I got a Marshall scholarship to study in the UK. Is that loud enough? I'm not speaking especially loud. But, and I went and did what started out, I guess, as a master's program in comparative labor history at the University of Warwick in Coventry. And it rapidly expanded to a PhD. The scholarship was for 2 years initially, and was extendable for a third. And in Britain, normally you don't have to do much coursework. So I found myself very quickly with a PhD in social history. And I had intended, actually, to go back to do more graduate work in the U.S. I probably would have done it either in sociology or political science. Those were things I was considering, probably at Harvard or MIT, where I had contacts. But instead, I got offered a postdoctoral research fellowship at King's College, Cambridge University. And I was actually in the position of running an interdisciplinary research project, which was called Shop Floor Bargaining, Job Control, and National Economic Performance. And you can imagine that, I guess I was probably about 25 at the time, that the thought of going back and being a graduate student as opposed to being, you know, an independent research fellow in an exciting place like King's College, and then being able to hire colleagues and to organize conferences and workshops and so on was much more attractive. I was concerned about what kind of jobs I would be able to get in the U.S. with my British history PhD, but I imagined that the Cambridge imprimatur would help a bit there, and it did. So then at the next turning point, which was actually in 1984, I applied for jobs on both sides of the Atlantic. I was offered an assistant professorship in history at Harvard and a lectureship in, I guess, modern social and economic history at Birkbeck College in London University. And that was basically tenured after 3 years probation, whereas the Harvard job was effectively untenurable, so I took that. And there, you know, I taught mainly British social economic history, strong emphasis on labor, and I always had contacts with the world of industrial relations. In fact, I think that I applied for some industrial relations jobs when I was I went on the job market in 1984, but wound up instead getting a job in history. And then in 1989, I was approached by the Industrial Relations School of Cornell to apply for a job in comparative industrial relations. I think that came about because I had edited a book on the international automobile industry and workers, and Harry Katz from Cornell had come to that. And in the course of that, I asked Wolfgang Streit to write me a reference, who I knew from various conferences that I had been to. And he said, well, sure, I'll write you a reference, but would you potentially be interested in being considered for a job in Wisconsin? And it was not something I'd ever considered in the past, but in 1990 I came out to Madison. I gave a talk and was eventually offered a joint appointment in history and industrial relations.
And that was 1994?
1991.
91.
Well, no, 1990, and I took up the appointment in 1991.
Okay.
And I've been here since.
Okay. And when...
And that was a tenured appointment, by the way.
Okay. And so when you were at Warwick, you got your master's and PhD there. What was the focus of your dissertation?
Well, the title was Craft Regulation and the Division of Labor, and it was a study basically of printing workers and machinists in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And the focus of it was on new technology and the organization of work. I was rather interested in the debates that were then going on in sociology and in industrial relations around skill and de-skilling. And so I was looking at two occupations that had experienced a major phase of technical change, and I was asking what accounted for the differential experience of skilled workers in these occupations with being able to kind of capture control of the new technology.
Hmm. What kinds of things led you to your interest in social studies and labor history and those kinds of things?
Well, I think it was a combination of different sorts of factors. I grew up in New York City in the late 60s, early 70s. I was active in the anti-war movement. I was exposed to Marxism, so I was interested in a whole set of issues coming out of the radical left. And I was quite attracted, I think, to issues around questions of autonomy at work. That was the kind of motivating sort of issues in my dissertation, and something that's interested me since then as well. I had always been interested in history, and I'd been drawn particularly to British history. This was partly because in the 60s and 70s, some of the most exciting work in social and labor history was being done in the UK. And if you wanted to find a kind of radical working class that was engaged with issues around the control of work, Britain was a very good place to go and look. That was kind of what drew me into it.
My sense from having interviewed some other people is that scholars have been drawn to IR sometimes, as you were, out of a sort of the intellectual ferment that was interesting, and other people had worked in factories or had a father who worked in a factory or grew up in a working class environment or had job experiences that pushed them in that direction.
No, that wasn't the case for me, really. I mean, I grew up in a solidly, New York liberal household, which, was, in retrospect, fairly progressive, but I was in no sense a red diaper baby. I knew a lot of people I came into contact later on in high school and afterwards with people who had really grown up in socialist or communist families. But no, I would say I grew up in a Jewish intellectual household with progressive values. But the world of work was, in some sense, I won't say exotic, but I've always been interested, for example, in ethnographic approaches. And that is partly because it was not a direct part of my own experience, blue-collar work, but a world to be discovered and learned about.
When you came to Wisconsin in 91, did you immediately become involved in IR?
Yes, I was basically hired through IR, and I already had a very interdisciplinary profile as somebody, very unusual for a historian. I was already extensively involved in theoretical debates. I was extensively involved in comparative work, which straddled the boundary between looking at the past and looking at the present. I had already written, for example, an essay which was called From Labor History to the History of Industrial Relations. It was trying to develop a new sort of paradigm for labor history. I was quite involved with industrial relations. And I mean, quite frankly, given the way in which the discipline of history was moving, which is to say, away from being interested in the economy, away from being interested in labor, much more towards cultural kinds of issues. Mm-hmm. I think it's very unlikely that I would have been hired, at the initiative of a history department. So it was very much the personal connection to, Wolfgang Streeck, the needs of the institute, and having a pretty high scholarly profile, and so being attractive to a mainstream department, even if it wouldn't have been a their initiative, but I would have been hired.
So Wolfgang Streeck was here when you came, and
yes.
Then my guess is he was teaching the comparative courses,
yes,
is that right?
Yes,
so
yes.
What were you teaching at that point?
I was teaching them too. We were sharing them, basically.
Okay.
I mean, he basically recruited me in order to build a comparative sub-program within the Institute that would be relatively academic in orientation, that would be of high scholarly quality.
And the focus would be more on PhD students rather than the professional master's students?
We didn't really discuss that. I mean, in retrospect, coming here I was naive in various ways. I very much wanted to come back to the United States for personal reasons. I had kids who were then 2.5 and 5, and so I was really looking for a place that was sort of above some notional bar in terms of a place to live, in terms of the scholarly quality of the institution, and the range of things that I could do. And I'm, in retrospect, I overlooked a lot of things about the precarious position of the Industrial Relations Institute. On the other hand, I came with tenure, so you might say that it wasn't as risky for me as it would have been for somebody else. So we didn't talk about whether the focus would be on PhD students, but I think, mentally, that's probably what we had in mind.
Mm-hmm. Did your involvement with the Institute change over time then? My understanding is that Wolfgang Streeck at some point moved out of IR.
Well, he moved a quarter. He was originally a half appointment in IR and sociology, and he became more and more involved in sociology. He was working closely with Joel Rogers. He set up the economic sociology program in sociology, which I've since moved into as well. And I think he was somewhat frustrated with the industrial relations program for various reasons that we can talk about in a moment. And he saw opportunities to gain more influence within sociology. He had an attractive offer from a German university, and he used, as part of the retention package, he moved a further quarter of his appointment out of IR.
Mm.
For me, that was certainly, a moment when I realized that the situation was more problematic than I had originally realized.
Mm. But then did that also give you an opportunity to move into IR more?
No, I was already 50% in IR. I was already doing comparative teaching. I was working with Wolfgang, and then the problem was that Wolfgang was not as present. And fairly soon after that, he was offered the directorship of this Max Planck Institute, which was kind of dream job that nobody could turn down, and therefore he left.
Was that a turning point for the Institute, his departure?
I think it was part of a turning point for the Institute. I mean, obviously,
That was, 94, 95?
95 or so. He was certainly, I think it was a turning point for the Institute in some respects when he chose to move part of his appointment out of it. That was a signal to a very important department, namely sociology, which could have taken up some of the relay of the declining interest of economics, that the strongest and most disciplinary-oriented scholar from their point of view within the Institute was saying that actually he would rather work directly in the sociology department than mm-hmm. continue to invest in the Institute. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that colored subsequent attitudes towards the Institute within sociology. Mm-hmm. There are, if you look at the situation in California, that would be a place where I think both at Berkeley and at UCLA, sociologists continue to remain quite interested in industrial relations and to be very active in running the industrial relations institutes at those universities. And they mm-hmm. worked with the legislature and with the labor movement to build, to get this big grant for work and labor, work labor employment institute, which mm-hmm. Unfortunately then when Schwarzenegger came in, he cut that budget allocation. But and I won't say necessarily that that's the way the institute here in Madison could have gone, but it's a possible direction. And the linkage between sociology and industrial relations is one that makes good sense for both sides. Mm-hmm.
Was the link between IR and history not such a good connection, given what you said?
No, it was not a very successful mm-hmm. connection. There was mm-hmm. David Zondervan, mm-hmm. The history department had a long history of making a mess of the field of labor history. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues there is that the State Historical Society is one of the best archival collections of labor and business records. And for many years, it was thought that the History Department should hire a U.S. labor historian. There was a guy who was in the Extension School, I'm blanking out, Bob Ozan, who is a quite well-known, rather conservative labor historian. And somehow, from my understanding, he blocked the History Department from making appointments in this area for a long time. And then the History Department was always a very divided department, and they basically looked at most of the premier labor historians in the United States, and for one reason or another, decided they weren't the right for them. And then they wound up hiring at the junior level, and they hired, this was all before I came, this guy David Zondervan, who was by any accounts an extremely weak scholar. He managed to publish a book with Oxford University Press, but which was on sort of attitudes to work among early factory workers in New England in the pre-Civil War era, but it basically didn't have an argument. And the History Department tenures almost all of its faculty who kind of do the basics, that is, are decent teachers mm-hmm. and produce a book and get it published. And so he was one of the very few people who did not, in fact, get tenure. He went off to North Carolina State University. Mm-hmm. So that was certainly not a very satisfactory connection. But he was there when I arrived. And I suppose there was some thought that it would be nice to have a European labor historian as well. And I made some efforts to get them interested in a colleague who did Japanese labor history. But really, there wasn't that much interest in the history department. It was not an especially good fit. And besides, almost by definition, labor history is more an academic direction. And I don't think you could ever build a professional industrial relations program around labor history. And perhaps if you were, had large numbers of students who were going into the labor movement, then as part of a kind of labor education thing, labor history could be quite attractive.
Did you feel that given what you said about the history, and I don't know if you meant history as a discipline or history as a department at this university, moving away from
Both, actually.
Economics and more toward cultural
history
issues?
History as a discipline. Mm-hmm. And I think what's happened here is just reflective of the broader trends in the discipline.
But, well, given that, was it difficult for you to be 50% in IR? Do you feel that they didn't value the work that you were doing for industrial relations?
Well, again, I was quite naive about how the university worked. I mean, the situation of the Institute in terms of joint appointments and in terms of getting work done for the Institute valorized within the university was abysmal. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was not for many years until I realized that basically the work that I was doing in IR was not at all being counted for my merit raises or anything like that. I was 100% tenured in IR, I mean, in history, 50% payroll in IR, and basically the decisions about recognition and merit payments and so on were all being taken 100% in history. Mm-hmm. The IR director might be in some way consulted, but it didn't have any serious say. It was a completely defective situation. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had relatively good relations with my history colleagues, at least in the early phase, so I wasn't too hard done by, but gradually I realized that I was doing all this work. I was relatively central to the IR program, I was relatively peripheral to history, and that was the only thing that mattered.
That leads to the next question, which is, did the relationship between your tenure department and IR change over the years?
Well, basically what happened was that I changed my relationship to my tenured department because I was invited to get more involved with sociology. After Wolfgang left, they wanted somebody who would do comparative economic sociology. And at first I taught a course for them on the IR budget, and it was obvious that that wasn't really, something that could be continued because it wasn't in the interest of IR. And eventually, with the support of some colleagues in sociology, I was able to move a quarter into sociology. I might have considered at that point moving part of it out of IR, but Marianne Fitzpatrick was the associate dean at that point, and she said, well, whatever you do, don't move anything out of IR. I mean, that we were already struggling to keep the Institute afloat. And so I moved effectively a quarter of my appointment out of history into sociology. This was about 1998, 1999. And at the same time, I became director of the EU Center. And that brought me an additional course release. Mm. And so I stopped teaching in history about that point. And then, when the Institute actually closed, that gave me the opportunity to restructure my appointment more comprehensively and to move the remaining quarter out of history into sociology and to move the half from IR into public affairs.
So you're now 50% LaFalle at 50% Soch.
Yes, I retain what's called a courtesy appointment in history. I can still call myself professor of history. I can supervise PhD theses in history, but I'm no longer a voting member of history executive committee, and I really don't have that much contact with the department anymore. Mm.
Okay. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk more specifically about the Institute. How would you define the Institute's mission during the years that you were affiliated with it?
Well, I don't think it had a very clear mission. I think that was part of the problem. I mean, there was a sense that there was an academic sub-discipline of industrial relations that people were committed to varying degrees. There was a mission of, you know, training people who would go into the professional field of industrial relations, which itself was multifarious and changing. You know, might have been thought to have had three components: the sort of human resource management component, the training people who would work in the labor movement, and then training people who would work in government or in other kinds of public interest-oriented activities around industrial relations. And, you know, the ethos was that these three components were on an equal footing, and that was a distinctive feature of Wisconsin. In practice, it kind of came and went. I mean, some years, overwhelmingly, the students would be in the master's program would be want to go into management. Some years, you know, there would be a third or 40% who had union or public interest kinds of concerns. So I would say that, you know, if there was a mission, it went in that direction. I think that there was also interest in, you know, kind of serving a public role for Wisconsin, which had been, you know, in many respects, a leader in the labor relations field. I think a lot of people were interested in that. I should say that there were plenty of people among the older faculty, who I didn't get to know very well, who had been active in various kind of mediation, arbitration roles, which historically was a big thing that academics did in the industrial relations field.
Part of the Wisconsin idea.
Yeah, and part of the academic discipline of industrial relations. I mean, if you look at the Industrial Relations Research Association, typically the presidency will revolve between maybe a union person, maybe a management person, maybe a pure scholar, and often a mediator or arbitrator. Mm-hmm. So those are the kind of roles involved.
Well, you mentioned that there was really not a clear mission, or that it moved depending on who was around. Was there also not clear leadership or forceful leadership?
I think I would say that was true. That and basically, you know, one way to look at the situation is that Wisconsin had been a leader in the field of industrial relations in the post-war period. Many of the most distinguished people were either retiring or nearing retirement in the late 1980s. Jerry Summers, Jack Barbash, Everett Casalo, none of them were really teaching when I got here. And there were a range of people who were definitely, you know, those were all people who had totally been presidents of the Industrial Relations Association. Then there were people who were definitely, you know, kind of tier below in terms of scholarship. Well, I won't name any names specifically, and I'd actually have to go back and think about who they were. But, you know, when I first arrived, I guess Dick Miller was director, Craig Olson had just been director. We didn't have a kind of relatively strong director until Paul Roos came on board, and then in about 1985. I mean, I guess I would say that there was not that much intellectual activity around the Institute when I first arrived. It was not a place where there was a kind of constant stream of exciting visiting speakers or conferences or people presenting their work to each other and so on. I think, in a way, what had happened was that the economics department had lost interest. There was Saul Levine, another very distinguished person on the comparative side, but again, had basically retired by the time I got here. Mm-hmm. Most of these people, in fact, all of them, I think, had appointments in economics. So economics was moving in a different direction. Probably the most active people, in some respect, were in the business school. I didn't find them very intellectual. I had almost nothing in common with them. And then there were a few people more on the social science side, like Paul in economics, like Wolfgang. There was Craig Olson, who's in the business school, who was, of those people was the most scholarly and was the most engaged with the discipline of industrial relations as it was evolving. Mm-hmm. So there was a kind of structural problem, was it? There was a kind of a vacuum there, I would say.
So the weaknesses were people retiring and not being replaced.
Different disciplines moving in different.
Oh, okay.
It had a fabulous international reputation. It was really one of the founding places for industrial relations as a field. It had superb alumni who felt very connected to the Institute, alumni and academics, people like Tom Koch and others, but also alumni in management and in the labor movement. It had strong connections to the labor movement and to public policy in Wisconsin. It had lots of interest from overseas students coming in. It had corporations who were willing and happy to hire the products. It had the potential advantage of being a focus for interdisciplinary study of work and employment, which, unquestionably remained and remains a fundamental topic both for academic study and for public policy. Mm-hmm.
My understanding of other IR programs is that they tend not to have the international component that Wisconsin has, which I see as a real strength, particularly given the internationalization of corporations and so on.
And I think it depends on the place. Actually, there are. Mm-hmm. Cornell has an excellent, which is clearly the leading institution, has an excellent international group. They have three or four people, working on different world regions and different themes, and they're relatively cohesive. So they're certainly quite active internationally. I think that, some of the kind of historically lesser programs at places like Michigan State University or the University of Illinois Champaign, Urbana, or Penn State University, which came from less cosmopolitan universities in most cases and were more applied in their orientation. It's true, they, on the whole, didn't have the same international orientation and connections.
But those places are thriving and Wisconsin's institute is not, and I'm wondering what do you see as the reason for that?
Well,
given the strength of the importance of international issues.
Well, what we have to remember in terms of the decline and closure of the institute, that it had no trouble recruiting students. It had no trouble placing its students. It's not that. By some measure, it was a drain on the resources of the university. This university doesn't work like that. It doesn't, for better in some respects and also for worse, it doesn't use a kind of activity-based costing model. It doesn't say, well, what does each unit bring in and what does it cost at the university? Mm-hmm. The university has a set of priorities which are determined, you know, internally. And so, you know, I think the crisis of the Institute was above all a crisis of recruitment of faculty. And that, in turn, was connected to the evolution of certain of the disciplines within the College of Letters and Science. It was connected to the failure to achieve departmental or tenure-granting status in the 1980s and early 90s. And then eventually it was determined by the strategic outlook of the deans of the college that this was not an area they wanted to invest in. And in all of these respects, it was a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if you don't appoint people, or you make it very difficult to appoint people, then you don't build up a constituency within the adjacent disciplines within the college, and then it's possible to say, well, you know, look, there's no faculty interest in this.
Why do you think that the administration was willing to let IR go?
Well, I think that, you know, the university is a very departmentally oriented institution. And in part, this is the flip side of strong faculty governance. So the real units in the university are the departments. And they have a lot of the power, they have most of the prestige. And the university has historically struggled to create horizontal, cross-disciplinary institutions, mechanisms, centers, even where the top leadership of the university has considered that that's very important. The cluster hires. Are an example, and you know, I think those will be hard to keep going in some kind of institutionalized way. International studies has been one major institutional source of these kinds of cross-disciplinary activities, and that's one reason why I've been increasingly drawn into international studies. And some years ago, probably in the mid-90s, Dave Trubeck wrote a report for probably Donna Shalala when she was chancellor called Managing the Matrix, and it was about the relationship between the kind of vertical pillars of the departments and the horizontal pillars or structures which were meant to encourage cross-disciplinary work. And you know, he basically pointed out how weak those were relative to the vertical pillars, and how there was in many respects a failure to align resources and rewards within the university to the professed desires of people higher up in the administration. For a more cross-disciplinary kind of approach. I think that, you know, the Institute suffered from that. It suffered from being, you know, in some sense, a professional field inside the College of Letters and Science. It was a cross-college enterprise, but whose home was within the College of Letters and Science. And I think the college could never decide, really, which way it wanted to play things. The college is by far the biggest unit within the university. It's been very reluctant to let any units go for fear of setting up rival centers of power and weakening its influence. For example, the LaFollette School would like to be an independent unit, and it's never been allowed to be, I think, for this kind of reason. If you carved out all of these anomalous units from within the college would be diminished relative to the university. But on the other hand, you know, the college did not value or recognize the kinds of things that the institute did, and running a professional master's degree, that's not something, whether it was lucrative, whether the students could be placed, relative to the academic department center mission, focused on the rankings of departments in, you know, their national hierarchies, that just wasn't something that was of real interest to the college.
Well, there was a review done, I believe, in 1994, or no, 92, I'm sorry. So this was shortly after you arrived, that was a quality reinvestment exercise or something, and the entire college was reviewed, and the committee that looked at industrial relations and a lot of the other programs in the social science division recommended substantial cuts for industrial relations, journalism, social work, you know, the schools that offered professional degrees, and also ethnic studies, international studies, yeah. Afro-American studies. And at this point, now these other places are thriving, and IR has gone belly up. And I'm wondering why, you know, why did these other programs manage to survive that axe and IR didn't?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure, you know, I could answer that without looking more closely at them. I mean, probably, you know, La Follette is the one I know most about, and it was never proposed to be cut. I think that there, what's been important, you know, is twofold. One has been the strong support from members of the political science department for La Follette, and the willingness of economists to work within La Follette as well, although often you get people with an economics background who are not actually in the economics department, because it's a more applied kind of field. You know, and secondly, the feeling that it's quite important for the university to have a public policy role and to interface with the legislature and state and local government within Wisconsin, which is historically what La Follette has done, though it's now to nationalize itself to a greater or lesser degree. I do think that the fact that the Institute was really a cross-college venture, in which had stakeholders in the law school, especially in the business school and the engineering school, but was basically under the governance of the College of Letters and Science, was a very undesirable arrangement. The combination of not having tenure granting authority and of being within the unit that probably valued it least in some respects was a very unfavorable arrangement. Now, I don't know how things have, you know, why some of those other units which were threatened have thrived. I do know that, you know, an important mistake probably was in the 80s, there had been resistance to departmentalization from the IR faculty because they were close to economics and they felt that this would drive a wedge between the two institutions. I believe that there were at least two committees, one in the late 80s and one in the early 90s, that looked at IR and recommended departmentalization. And, you know, it's perfectly clear that the administration didn't act on its recommendations. The committee, the reinvestment exercise, I believe it was chaired by Earl Kliavin, who was a professor of sociology, and that review was very much described at the time as the kind of discipline's department's revenge. So, you know, folk faced with budgetary cutbacks, you know, the departments sort of banded together and said, well, cut the interdisciplinary units, which had grown up in a period when soft money was more widely available and when hard choices had to be avoided. And at every turn, when the universities has faced, you know, cutbacks, that has been the tendency.
Yeah, sort of pull back and just focus on the core disciplines.
Right. And if you look at the leadership of the college, the deans, you know, have typically come from strong departments. And when I arrived, Dave Cronin from history had been the longtime dean. He then was replaced by Phil Certain, who's a chemist. And, you know, chemistry very much a top-ranked department in its field. Phil very focused on departments, and you know, we now have a situation, you know, and in which the dean of the college and the associate dean for the social sciences both are sociologists, the number one ranked department. And I think actually very well, especially of Gary Sandifer. I think it was a good appointment. But I mean, you can see that's how the college works. I think that you know, Chuck Halaby was consulted about the future of industrial relations when he was chair of sociology in the mid-90s. You know, and although he's definitely somebody who works on topics connected to industrial relations, he's never been involved with industrial relations. He's very focused on sociology as a discipline, and didn't really see any purpose in the IR Institute.
Well, given what you've said about the perhaps administrative mismatch with IR being housed in a place that that isn't ideal, and the problems getting tenure granting authority and inability to recruit and so on, what things were done to preserve the institute that might have worked?
Well, I mean, basically, at the time of this quality reinvestment exercise, it was very clear that the college had taken a decision that they would like to run down IR and starve it of resources and close it as one of the, you know, potentially less painful ways of meeting cuts. I was told of a dinner at which Phil Certain is dean of the college and Andy Policano is dean of the business school sat together and cut a deal that they would basically run down and close IR. Someone who was at the dinner reported that to me. And they backed off only because the Institute mobilized its very strong alumni network. And so various promises were made about appointments, and indeed IR was allowed to recruit, but since the structural problems of finding tenure homes were not addressed, on the whole that recruitment was not very successful. So my own view is that none of the plans for you know, fixing the institute could really have been successful without addressing the structural institutional problems of its location within the college, of its relationship to other departments, of its ability to make tenure appointments.
So the offers, there were offers made to Anna Kalleberg,
Murray? Well, you're skipping.
Oh, I'm skipping. Yeah, I'm skipping ahead.
So then, gradually, what happened was that people, key faculty, left. And of course, you know, Paul Voos had been the long-term director, and she was somebody who was, she's since become president of the IRRA. She is a distinguished figure within the profession. She was very uncomfortable in the economics department. And she could see the writing on the wall. She couldn't get new appointments made. You know, the institute was limping along. And so she was offered this job. First, she was approached to become director of the Institute in Illinois, and then she was offered this job at Rutgers. And, you know, the college didn't try very hard to keep her, so she left. And then Craig Olson stepped in. He was the other person, but this time from the business school, who was really very identifying with industrial relations as a discipline, very, very high profile within that discipline. And he came up with various kinds of proposals, and you know, kind of nice noises were made, but nothing actually happened. For example, the university decided not to invest in a cluster hire for industrial relations. That would have been a good way to revive the institute. And actually, Craig came up with a very good proposal around, you know, industrial relations as an interdisciplinary field focused on the study and governance of employment. You know, I think if you go back and read that proposal, it was of high intellectual quality. It was of substantial potential interest. It got some distance within the selection process, but didn't make it through. And, you know, this was also a political process in which the support of the relevant deans was critical, was not forthcoming. So at that point, you know, there was a remobilization of the alumni. There was a promise to try to recruit an outside director. This was probably about in 1998, 99, I think. I came to a head while I was on leave in Florence in the spring of 1999. And Craig eventually accepted this offer, a very attractive offer from Illinois. And at that point, the outside search was initiated as a kind of first step to a solution. And it's always very hard to recruit an outside senior person. I think that the estimates are that, you know, probably only 20% of such searches are actually successful. But you can readily understand that somebody coming into this sort of position would want to feel really sure that the key administrators, and especially the College of Letters and Science, were committed to it, and that there would be a package of faculty appointments that would be available, and that some serious move would be taken to address the institutional problems, the problems of tenure granting status. And I think it was always hard to know how serious people were and what their reasons for eventually turning down the job. I think both Caliburn and Morris Kleiner were pretty good appointments. They would have been recognized as sending, you know, a signal to the discipline that Wisconsin was serious about rebuilding in this area. They each had personal reasons for not coming, but I think that they were not convinced either that they would get the support that would be needed from the college, and especially from Phil Certain as dean. And
so was it not a good faith effort?
I think it was I won't say it was a totally cynical effort, but I think it was a not entirely good faith effort. You know, I mean, to be fair to Phil and to the college has limited resources. It has many claims on its resources. And he always followed a strategy of, you know, a kind of wait-and-see strategy, not a proactive investment strategy. I think that's true across the board. I mean, it's not only industrial relations, but sometimes if you want to make something work, you have to make upfront commitments. Mm-hmm. If you have something which is in a precarious situation, then you can't take the view of, well, you know, we'll make this one appointment, and then if the person proves themselves, maybe we'll make more available. It's, you know, you have to put all the pieces of the puzzle together in advance. And I do think that Phil was never convinced of the rationale for keeping industrial relations going. I think that his father was actually active in a union, mm-hmm. and that he personally was convinced that unions were an obsolete institution in the modern world, and that industrial relations was basically about studying unions, and therefore, you know, there wasn't that much point in keeping the thing going. So I think he was responding to the expressions of interest and protest, especially on the part of the alumni. But I think, you know, plan B was always, well, you know, we'll run these searches. If they succeed, fine, we'll see. Maybe we'll invest mm-hmm. more. If not, then we'll be able to say, well, we looked and we didn't find. But there was a very strong element of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm-hmm. And this was particularly clear when we got to Adrian Eden.
Hmm. Why do you think that last one failed?
I think it was a pretty last-ditch kind of attempt. I mean, there's no question that she was a weaker scholar than, nobody could say Kallenberg or Kleiner weren't, you know, good scholars, weren't people mm-hmm. that the university would be proud to have. You know, Adrian Eaton was a PhD of the university, PhD of the Institute. She'd done some good work. She had some leadership qualities. I think she could have done a good job rebuilding the Institute. But nobody could say that she was an outstanding scholar. And it brought to a head the question about, you know, tenure home. She had to have a tenure home specially designed for her. And so it was a kind of cart before the horse thing. So in effect, it wasn't very surprising that the divisional committee raised some questions about her, raised some questions about tenuring her in industrial relations when there was no clear plan for tenure-granting authority for industrial relations. And then basically, you know, Phil as dean didn't, it would have been up to him to say, well, you know, I know this is anomalous, but I'm committed to it, and here's why you should do this. Mm-hmm. He didn't do that. He left her hanging, and naturally she was embarrassed and unconvinced mm-hmm. that it would be worthwhile to come here, even if it worked out. And so she pulled out, and that was the end of that.
She might have spent a lot of time beating her head against the wall trying to
I think it's perfectly likely, actually.
And once she withdrew her candidacy, can you talk a little bit about what happened after that in terms of trying to find a director for the Institute?
Yeah. And there, you know, I think it's pretty clear that Phil as dean did not behave in good faith, that he did not really want a solution. Because first, Chuck Hallaby, as associate dean, actually approached the thing with a very strong problem-solving kind of approach. Barry Gerhardt, who's a, you know, distinguished industrial relations scholar and committed to the field, you know, was prepared to take it on within the business school. And when Chuck brought back his name to Phil, he was simply told, oh, what are you thinking of? You know, this guy, we'd have to pay this guy's salary. We want to save money. We don't want to spend money here. And so he withdrew that. And then I got involved, and then I felt that And, you know, I needed to step up, and I had a sabbatical coming up. It was not something I really wanted to do. So I drew up a kind of turnaround plan for the Institute, and I proposed if the turnaround plan were accepted. It had various components. It particularly focused on rebuilding the research aspect of the Institute. That I would be willing to serve as director. I did want some compensation for deferring my sabbatical. I wanted to ensure that I would be able to take the sabbatical at the end of the period in question. And basically, Chuck was first favorable to that and then unfavorable, I think, because he checked with Phil. I mean, Chuck himself is someone who never took a sabbatical, and he didn't seem to think that was very important, so that may have been a factor. But I think that basically, when they were faced with having to give some kind of quid pro quo for my deferring my sabbatical and serving as yet another interim director, they decided no, they wouldn't do that at all. And there were some advantages to having in the interim director be the associate dean, because I'm not sure I would have wanted to do this, but previous directors had used their position to mobilize outside support to defend the Institute, whereas that would be much harder to do if you had somebody from the College of Letters and Science Dean's office running the Institute. And I think that that's, if you look at what happened, in contrast to previous attempts to close the Institute, you didn't get the student and alumni mobilization until the key decisions had already been taken. It was a fait accompli. Mm-hmm. I think people were also a bit demoralized by the failure of success of searches for a new director, mm-hmm. but I think that was quite critical as well.
Well, my memory is that a lot of the decisions were made in the summer when students were gone.
Oh, yeah.
And many of the faculty were gone.
Right.
So it all happened very quickly and kind of behind the scenes.
Yeah, and I think it was done deliberately for that mm-hmm. reason.
Sort of speculating, but if this had worked out that you had been appointed as interim director for a year or two and the money had worked out so you could take your sabbatical later, it might have just been another stringing along of
things. Oh yeah,
things.
I'm quite grateful.
Okay.
And I think I handled it correctly by, making some conditions for taking it on, not just for me personally, but also in terms of some commitment to the plans I was proposing, because it would have been a total waste of my time to do it if they were really determined to close it anyway, and they had no intention of making additional resources available or solving the tenure home authority mm-hmm. kinds of issues. So I was actually grateful that, in the end, that they pulled the plug on that rather than stringing me along.
Has
I'm gonna have to stop pretty soon. I'd say about 5 minutes.
Has the closing of the Institute left a teaching and research void in terms of the employment relationship, or are these Is this kind of work being done elsewhere on campus?
Well, I think it's still being done on campus in certain areas, but in a more fragmented way. There are people in the business school who are doing it. There's Chip Hunter, who was hired in the business school, who would have been an important faculty member at IR mm-hmm. continued. There are some of his colleagues who, in the management department, who work on these kinds of things. I'd say Chip is the person who I personally would recognize as a real IR mm-hmm. Scholar. There is certainly a lot of interest in work and employment within the sociology department, not only within the economic sociology program, which has been pretty focused on that, but also in the sociology of economic change and development. I mean, Gay Seidman does a lot on that sort of thing. So does Jane Collins. I mean, there is certainly a kind of community of scholars, mostly attached to the sociology department, with interests in these kinds of areas. And there are, you know, students elsewhere, and probably faculty too, around the university doing it. We've talked about, you know, trying to set up some kind of center. For a long time, we had this Labor on the Global Economy research circle in international studies. That's kind of gradually wound down, but it may be that we'll pick it up again in the future. I'm teaching next semester an undergraduate course on sociology of work and employment. Gay is teaching a course on sweatshops. I've said that I will teach a course in the fall on labor and the global economy. So, you know, there are...
There are little pockets here and
there.
That's
right. The question is, you know, pulling it together in some sort of way. I think that probably the biggest, you know, kind of vacuum is in terms of, you know, the larger Wisconsin community and the state, where there is an ongoing, you know, interest in using the expertise of the university, and where it's more fragmented. I suppose that COWS is the main body that is really doing policy-relevant research, and to some extent, the Follett and the Institute for Research on Poverty are also doing some stuff. But, you know, especially from the point of view of the unions, there is a sense of loss and abandonment by the university. I had a former history PhD student of mine, who now is an officer of AFSCME, approached me and asked how we could get started again the internship that for AFSCME that IRI used to provide. But we're exploring doing that through the Follett and through sociology. So, you know, I think that the university still has a strong legacy in this area, and we'll have to, you know, review in the future whether new kinds of institutional mechanisms are necessary to draw together the different things that people are doing at different units. Maybe that's a good point to stop.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.